But it's good to be here. I appreciate your work and your stand for the truth and the work that you've done, and not only are doing now, but what you have done through the years and your stand here in this county as a beacon and a light, a beacon for truth, a beacon for standing and holding up in the face of opposition that we have right here, opponents in this county especially. And I appreciate that and your stand. My topic tonight is dealing with pride, jealousy, and envy. And I don't know how long it will last. There's a lot that could be said, and I won't say it all. I mentioned to my father that I was going to be talking about pride, jealousy, and envy. He said, well, that's a whole series. And I said, yeah, it won't last that long for me, though. But it's a good study. It's been good for me to study this again, to look at some things. And I hope as we go through this evening, that it will be profitable for us in our study together. For Saul, King Saul, things started well. You know, if you turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 9, you have the story of this young man. Verse 2 describes him as a man who was a choice young man. And a goodly, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than from whom his shoulders and upward. He was higher than any of the people. Here was King Saul, physically tall, had a striking appearance about him. But yet he was humble in spirit. Later on, Samuel described Saul at the time that he was anointed to be king, and called to be king over God's people, that you were little in your own sight. And that's reference to the humility he had as a humble man serving. And not only do we see this, but in the 9th chapter, we see exactly what Samuel was talking about in the 15th chapter when he referred to that, where Saul answered in verse 21 when he's told that you're going to be the king. And he answered and he said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Wherefore then speakest thou unto me? You know what we see here is we see a humble man being called to do a great task, and he says, surely you're not calling me. What a pleasant person this would be to be around. And so here he is now, the king of God's people, and he is now to serve as a king. He's got to earn his way. He's got to, I guess, if you will, receive the loyalty of the people. So in the 11th chapter, he goes to battle with Israel among the Ammonites as they're in battle there at Jabesh-Gilead, and he's quickly caused to gain the Israelites' loyalty because of the victory that they had in this occasion. And they are now behind Saul, their king, and they are proud of him. But the success wasn't good for Saul. He was a humble man, but now here he is, a man who has received a little success, now received a little loyalty. People are looking to him. You are King Saul. And he begins to pray. I'm King Saul. And that was one mistake he made. As we go on and we read through the chapters here, we can turn over and we can see where they come up into battle, and he makes two mistakes here. The first mistake we find is we turn over to the 13th chapter here of 1 Samuel chapter 13, and we see where the Israelites are embattled against the Philistines at Michmash. And here he's given a precise order to wait 7 days, and he does that. He waits 7 days according to the set time of Samuel, verse 8, had appointed, but Samuel came not to Gilgal. And the people were scattered from him, and Saul said, bring hither the burnt offering and peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. It came to pass that as soon as he had made the end of the offering, and the burnt offering, he, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what hast thou done? Here you are, you're told to wait 7 days, and what you did is you went ahead and you went on in, and you did something you weren't supposed to do. The offering of sacrifices was for the tribe of Levi. But here he was, king, and he thought, I'm the king of Israel. I can do what I want.
he goes into office.
You know, we don't only see this mistake that he made, but in the 15th chapter, we see another grave mistake of Saul when he's told that they are to go out and they are going to be in battle against the Amalekites. And he is told there to go and to smite the Amalekites, to take everything that they have, to leave nothing there. As a matter of fact, in verse 3 of chapter 15, the command is given in this way, to utterly destroy all that they have and to spare them not. But slay both man and woman, infant, suckling, oxen, sheep, camel, and ass. And it says there that they went and they started, and Saul went out and departed and went down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you, verse 6, for he showed kindness to the children of Israel, and he came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites, and Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until he comes to Shur. That is over against Egypt, and he took Agag alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and the oxen, the fatlings, and the lambs, and all that was good, they would not utterly destroy them. Now here we have Saul making two great mistakes. And you say, why did he make these mistakes? Well, I'm going to say the problem that Saul had was his pride. Pride was his problem. The problem he had was that he saw himself as a man who was important, and he saw himself among the people of God as the leader of these people, and he saw himself now as the one who could make the choices, and he decided that I'm going to make the choices as to what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what is right in my own sight. You know, that reminds me of the children of Israel some years before, Samuel was judged, made judge over Israel. It says that the people did that which was right in their own sight. Here was Saul doing the very same thing, doing what was right in his sight, deciding what was right. Well, we don't only see pride in Saul, but we see the outcome of pride. And that is, as the story goes on through 1 Samuel, we're not going to look at this because it deals with David, but you remember how that they were in battle, and there was a Philistine giant by the name of Goliath, and there was everybody was afraid to go out and to battle this giant, this Philistine giant. And so David said, I'll go out there and I'll slay him. And so he went out and he took 5 smooth stones and he took them and hit Goliath and killed him. And so now David is the one that people are looking to. And they're loyal to him. And so as we come to 1 Samuel chapter 18, we have this event having taken place. And we come down as we read through this chapter, down to verse 6. It says, it came to pass that when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with the tabrets and with joy and the instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousand. And David is 10,000. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. What we see now is we see his pride. He sees them giving homage and honor to David. And now we see jealousy entering in. Entering in because of his pride, because of his elevated position of self, he now sees himself as one who has to protect himself against the one who is there receiving this, and that's David. And so now jealousy enters in, which then turns to envy, and now he's out to smite him, and that's the way he spends the rest of his life. And what a tragic end for Saul. He not only tries to destroy David directly with the sword and the javelin in his hand and would smite David, but indirectly giving his daughter to him, trying to ensnare him. He tried every way he could to get David. But finally, he ends his life by falling on his own sword. And we think, what a tragic end for a man who started so well. All because of pride, jealousy, and envy. Now, I said all that, and you said, we haven't even gotten to our lesson. But that's a story of pride, jealousy, and envy. And I think we can learn. I believe that lesson is there for us to teach us some things. It's to teach us that pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, as Proverbs 16:18 says. And we need to recognize that if with every sin there is a temptation before us. And with the sin of pride there are temptations before us, and we need to be aware of these temptations, and we need to turn from these temptations and flee from these temptations. And when we have fallen prey to these temptations, we need to repent of them and turn away from them and turn away from the sin and get our lives back right. Countless harm has been done and is still being inflicted upon God's people because of pride, jealousy, and envy. This evening, let's talk about pride, jealousy, and envy in the time we have. The first thing we want to ask the question, and that is, what is pride? Well, it is that which God hates. It is that which God hates. You know, in English language, we have the word pride, and we use it in different senses. As a matter of fact, the word pride in the English language actually has a connotation in which we use it in a good way. We don't use pride always in a negative sense. And I think originally maybe the word from which we get pride actually came from a word which had a good sense initially. But as time came, it came to be used in a bad sense, especially in the Scriptures as it is used in these senses. But in our language, in the English language, there is a good sense. For example, we might say, I'm proud of my family. And we are. We ought to be proud of our families. We ought to be proud of our wife and our husbands, as the case may be. Our children, our mothers, our fathers, we ought to be proud. If they're doing right, we ought to be proud of them. There's nothing wrong with having a proud based upon respect or elation, or based upon our relationship. We might say that we're proud of the congregation we are a member of. We're proud of the people whom we associate. We might say that we're proud to be Athenians, in case maybe here. I might say that I'm proud to be an Andersonian, because I'm from Anderson. We're proud. We're proud to be Alabamians, aren't we? You don't think that we're proud of that, just wait till football season rolls around and you let Alabama start play somebody in a bowl game. Now, I know we got Alabama and Auburn fans, and I know we always say that Auburn fans won't root for Alabama, but you let an Alabama play somebody like Notre Dame for number one, and I'll tell you what, down deep, those Auburn fans will probably pull for Alabama. And I can tell you because I'm an Auburn fan. See, we're proud. We want our state to look good. But in the way in which the terms are used in the Scripture, the word pride is that which denotes something that is not pleasant. It denotes, and synonyms of the word would be, in the Bible, would be arrogance. That which is puffed up. That which is boastful, just to name a few. Pride is insidious. It gradually strips us of the reality of the situation. That's what pride does. Pride will cause us to lose the reality of the situation. We lose the reality of self. Pride causes men to put much more worth in themselves than in God. It causes them to lose the reality of others. It causes them to begin to compare oneself with another. And then the task of trying to explain when you've compared yourself with another, in some way you have fallen short, and you begin to try to explain why you have fallen short. Have you ever heard somebody do that when they've not done as well as somebody else has? And rather than just saying, they're better than I am, they'll say, well, you know, I've been having trouble with my shoulder here. And boy, if I could have been here on a good day, I'd have beat you out there on that golf course. But boy, today my arm's hurting bad. You know, we can't just say, you're better than I am. Because pride oftentimes will get in our way. And if we're not careful, we will lose. We will compare ourselves with one another. We'll make excuses why we're not capable as being successful as another. And the problem is, this may be one thing out there on the golf course, and it may not really mean anything. But when it comes to people of God, and this attitude is bred and continues to persist, and it infiltrates the congregation of the Lord's people, and you begin to have people who are now envious and vying for preeminence among God's people, there's where the problem is. That's where the problem was with Saul. This brings on resentment of others, and for no other reason, because they have done that which God has put them. And I don't think I'm talking to people who've never seen this happen. where you have seen people get jealous, not because of anything else, but that somebody's upset because you are doing what's right. And they're mad. And they're jealous. And they're envious. Let us not be deceived. Pride is a powerful device of Satan. He uses it to capture the hearts of children of God, and it causes them to be inactivated, turned aside from doing what is right. Pride will condemn them because of their self-inflated opinion of themselves and not seeing themselves for who they really are. And so we need to be careful that we see pride as God sees it. That we see pride as a cancerous condition upon the heart of man. We might ask the question as we think about this, what is pride? And that is, how does pride show itself? Well, pride shows itself in several ways. It shows itself in the thoughts of men. The thoughts of men. In Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 7, the wise man says, "Be not wise in thine own eyes." Be not wise in thine own eyes. Over in Romans chapter 12, again, we have this same thought given again in chapter 12, where Paul is writing to the church at Rome, and in verse 16, he says, "Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not the high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits." The thoughts of men can be where we see pride oftentimes. And as I heard said recently, you need to be careful of your thoughts, for at any moment your thoughts may turn into words. And so we need to be careful. We need to be careful as our thoughts. And so as we begin to think about, are we prideful in our eyes, we need to ask the question, what are our thoughts on? What do we think? As I think about this, I think about what Paul said earlier to Rome, the church at Rome, here in chapter 12 and verse 3, when he's talked about the fact that they need to conform themselves to the Word of God, that they need to be renewing their mind, that they may prove what is acceptable and good and the perfect will of God. Verse 3 says, "For I say that through the grace of God given to me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly and as according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith." Here I think we're getting to the bulk of what the problem of pride is thinking of oneself more highly than they ought. And Paul is saying here in verse 3, he's saying, you be careful of that. And then he comes on down in verse 16, and he says, "Be of one mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate, and be not wise in your own conceits." He's saying, be careful of your thoughts. Well, that's where pride begins. As I think about thoughts and men, let's just think quickly. Over in Luke chapter 18, you remember the parable that Jesus told. But this is a perfect example of thoughts and how they will eventually lead to words. Here is the Pharisee and the publican that Jesus said that went up to the temple to pray. And the Pharisee stood with himself, verse 11 says, and prayed, "God, I thank thee that I'm not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican." Here he is, he's pride. Listen to him as he's praying. You can almost hear the pride building as he's saying, "I thank thee that I am not as." I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. You know, these are commendable things. But he's sitting there thinking. Not only is he thinking, but now he's praying. And he's praying with this prideful attitude. But it says that the publican would not so much as lift up his eyes in heaven, but smote himself upon his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." He says, "I tell you that this man went down to his house justified rather than the other." Why? Because the Pharisee was exalting himself to God, saying, "Look at how good I am. Look how fortunate you are to have me." But the publican was over there. He saw the reality of himself. And he said, "I am a sinner. And the only way I can be saved is by the grace of God." And he said, "God, be merciful to me." I will tell you what. Our thoughts can tell a whole lot about who we are. Our thoughts may be that we have control over things. control over the things of this life, we're not thinking like we ought. James chapter 4 and verse 14, 15, 16 says, "For what is your life? It is even as a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away." That's what your life is. Your life is a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Verse 15 says, "For you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." But notice what he says, "But now you're rejoicing and your boastings, and all such rejoicing is evil." Why? Because you think you're in control. And that's what the prideful man does. The prideful man's thoughts are that I'm in control of things. I don't need God. That's what the prideful man says. Songs like "I Need Thee Every Hour" are not songs that a prideful man finds any benefit out of at all, because he doesn't need the Lord. He doesn't need the Lord any hour because he's in control. Listen to somebody sometimes in the way they talk, and you can find out a lot about their thoughts. And when everything begins to be, "I've done this and I've done that," and not, "I'm thankful for what God has been able to do through me," you might find out a lot about the person. Now the next thing, let's go on. And that is that pride shows itself by its pretentious display to material things. Its pretentious display to material things. And this, you know, when we think about this, we might initially say, "Well, what do you mean by material things?" And I'm not going to re-preach. I think there was a lesson presented by Randall Hammock first night y'all did on dealing with the danger of materialism or something of that nature. So I'm not going to redo that lesson. But I think when we start to think of pride, a lot of times that's where we put pride, is in our things. You remember the rich man that came to Jesus and said, "Good master, what good thing may I do that I may inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said, "Why callest thou me good? There's none good but one, that is God." He said, "But if you'll be good, you know." He said, "Oh, I've done that. I've kept all the commandments from my youth up." He says, "What lack I yet?" And he says, "Well, if you'll be perfect, go and sell what thou hast and give to the poor and come and follow me." Here was a rich young man who I think had the pretentious display to and he could not allow his pride to sell those things and turn loose of those things and serve God. And Jesus knew that. And he was not able to do that. And he turned his back and went away sorrowful. For the record says he had great possessions. And a lot of people say, "Well, we don't have to worry about that. We're not rich in greed for goods. And we don't have all those kinds of problems." Well, I one day was reading, and somebody said, "I think that in the world, the standard of living, I think, was $3 a year is what the average person in this world makes a year, when you consider everybody." And I began to think about that. And I began to think, you know what? I don't know about the church here at Eastside. But I thought then, I said, this church at Anderson is a rich church. Not the world. Oh, we think we don't have. We're not rich because we don't have what somebody else has got. The pretentious display to material things is based upon pride. Having what the Joneses have got. I don't need it. It's not that I need that. I need it because he's got it. That's pride. We don't need that. Another thing that I think about this is I think about pride and pretentious to display of the material things. It says in James chapter 2, and this maybe is dealing with the way that we deal with people who have material things. In James chapter 2, you remember, let's just read, beginning verse 1, it says, "My brethren, have not faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect to persons." He's dealing with his idea of respect to persons. What's the respect of persons based upon that he's going to deal with? He says, "For there is one that come into your assembly, a man with gold ring and goodly apparel, and come also a poor man in vile raiment. And ye have respect unto him that weareth the gay cloak, and say unto him, Sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor man, Stand thou there, or sit here under my footstool." He said, "Are ye not then partial in yourselves and become judges of evil thoughts?" Where is this at? It's because of pride. Oh, when we have the good person that comes in and gets, "Oh yes, we want you to come back." Fella comes in, His raiment's not like he ought to be. And we don't pay any attention. I heard somebody one day, they said, no, this fella came in, he wasn't shaved. He had long hair. Came in old rotten blue jeans. So everybody thought, who in the world is that? But somebody took time to pay attention to it, to ask about it, to find out who he wanted. And they found out what he wanted was he had had some problems in his life. He had some problems in his life that he wanted to correct. He had been down to the depths of sin. And he said, I've got you. Oh, when he walked in, he didn't come in a nice family, nice clothing. On the outside, he looked like he had been battered and tarred. But what he had is he had a heart of gold. He wanted to learn. He wanted to study. And they took time to study. He learned eventually that there's some things he needed to do. He needed to shape himself up a little bit. When he came to church, he wore the best he had. I was down in Ocala, Florida just recently. And they were talking about prison ministry. This church down there in Ocala, they had people go to prison and preach there. And I know churches here in Athens also do that in limestone prison. Anyway, they were talking about this prisoner that was there. And he had this shirt on him. And the guy just told him, your shirt looks like it has been ironed. It looks like you've sent it to the cleaners. Here it is, his prison shirt. He says, you can't do that. How do you make your shirt look so? He says, well, what I do, he says, because it's Sunday. He says, I go and I wash that shirt. He says, then I let it nearly get dry. And then I place it. Who probably the first time he came to the prison service didn't care, didn't. All he was doing was going there because he is trapped and he couldn't go anywhere else. But he learned the gospel, he obeyed the gospel, and now he understands there's something important about going to services. What I'm saying here is that if we're not careful, we can have a pretentious display to material things. We can let that be what determines who we're going to talk to, who we're going to teach. And we need to make sure that we're not that kind of people. Next thing I want to notice, will you? Is that what we find out of this is a disrespect for God and His will and His way. As I think about this, I think about King Saul. This is what we saw in King Saul, wasn't it? When God's will was that he go down and utterly destroy the Amalekites and all that they have. And he did that until he came down where Agag was, and he decided to spare him. And then after that he decided, well, if I can spare Agag, I can spare the best of the world. We need to be careful that we don't just do what we want to do. You know, Jesus dealt with this idea of people just doing what they want to do according to what man has decided. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 7, where here he's talking to these Jews, these Pharisees, and he says to them in verse 7, he says, ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah the prophet prophesy of you, saying, this people draweth nigh to me with their mouth and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain they do worship me. In vain. Why? For they teach the doctrines. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men. They're not offering me according to what God. They're not offering what God wants. They're offering what they want. And how many people in the religious world today are offering what they want? They see coming to services as they get up here and the song leader gets up to lead the song. You know, in a lot of churches, we use that word in a general sense. They have their choirs, they have their performances get up there. And what church is, they're coming out there and they're in the audience and they're watching a performance. That's not what worship is. If we've got the idea of worship being a performance, something which is to make us happy, we are all wrong. We are not the audience. God is the audience. He's looking down on our worship. He's seeing our worship. Please him in our worship. It's not whether the preacher gets up there and says everything right, or whether the song leader gets all the songs pitched exactly right. That's not what it's all about. It's what our hearts are doing. Are we doing what God would have us do? Are we doing it the way He's told us to do it? This is worshiping according to His will and His way. Not will worship. Worshiping in a vain way. But let us notice, as we think about this, that it breeds a disrespect for God and His will, a promotion of His will over the will of others. And this makes pride, I guess, perhaps the worst of all the sins. Now you say, you spend a lot of time on pride, David. If you spend this much time on jealousy and envy, we won't ever get out of here tonight. I guarantee you I won't spend that much time on it. Because pride is the underlying cause to what jealousy and envy have and what they bring. Because pride is the culprit behind them. The lack of love for brethren, the speaking evil of brethren, the lack of rejoicing with a brother who has some good fortune come in their life. When we are told to rejoice with them that do rejoice, and what somebody comes a good fortune, and we say, oh, I'll tell you what, I wish I had that. The problem behind that is pride. So that's why we spend so much on pride. But let us notice now jealousy and envy. We think about jealousy and envy. We're looking at them together, and they're very similar in meaning, and they're often used in our English language even as synonyms. But there is a difference. There is a difference between the two. Matter of fact, Paul lists them as two distinct sins in the works of the flesh. In Galatians chapter 5, verses 19 and 21, he mentions them separately. So there are two separate things that are involved here. And I think there is a difference in jealousy and envy. Jealousy is that which involves the feelings of displeasure that is produced by witnessing or hearing of the advantages and the prosperity of another. That makes us jealous. As I got through this a while ago, that's what pride does. And it breeds upon jealousy when that happens. We now no longer can rejoice, but we have feelings of displeasure, and that causes jealousy. We're now jealous that it's not us that has happened to. It involves a longing after or coveting that which is the advantage or the possession of another as well. Those are definitions by Webster. But also, as we see this in envy, it is the stronger of the two between jealousy and envy words. The two words are different. And the difference here is that envy not only involves the ill feelings toward the other, but it also expresses itself in action of the one that is being envied. In other words, when you're envied, you take action against that one who you are envied. Jealousy and envy. We see these sins. They plagued men since the beginning of time. We've seen envy in the way that jealousy bred, and then envy caused action. And we see this, Cain and Abel is a perfect example from the beginning of time. What? The Lord had respect unto Abel's sacrifice. Why? Because he offered a sacrifice according to the Lord. Could not Cain have done the same? Yes. But what did Cain do? Cain was jealous and was wroth, and his envy caused him to slay his brother Abel. What about the sons of Jacob and Joseph when he was given the coat of many colors and they said, "Oh, behold, here comes the dreamer." They didn't like Joseph because he was the favorite son. They were jealous. And their jealousy then caused them to have envy, which was expressed in action by taking Joseph and throwing him into the pit and then selling him to the band of Ishmaelites, headed to Egypt. And there he went into Egypt and was sold into Potiphar's house and there lived in Egypt. And suffered many things because of their jealousy and envy. Of course, Saul, we've looked at earlier as we began our lesson. What about the envy and the jealousy of the Jewish leaders against Jesus? Who for envy sent him to the cross? Who had him hung on the cross? That's what Pilate said. He said, for envy they delivered him. That's why they did it. There's the difference. The difference is that jealousy is the ill feelings toward the other, the feeling of displeasure, where the other one has the ill feelings toward another, but it's expressed through action. I think that's the difference. Now we want to notice the reality of jealousy and envy. Let us be aware that jealousy and envy are problems for men, and that we can be overcome of them if we're not on guard.
In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, Peter says, be watchful. Because watch, your adversary, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walking about, seeking whom he may devour. One way in which he tries to devour us is through jealousy and envy. If he can get us to be envious and jealous of one another, then he can do havoc to the work of the Lord. When we look at what others can do and despise them for it, what a terrible thing that is. Jealousy and envy follow pride, as I've often already said, because it usually follows from one who's looking to self as the supreme over the other, and it breeds jealousy. It would be difficult, I think, for me to overstate the danger of jealousy and envy among God's people. And you say, I think you're making a lot more out of this than what it is. But I believe that today, even among brethren, this is one of the greatest hindrances to the work of the Lord, is this matter of jealousy and envy. It's caused problems among God's people. It has appeared among preachers. It has appeared among elders. It has appeared among Bible class teachers. It has appeared among song leaders. It has appeared among members. And what it has done, it is a disease that once it is around and in a congregation, that it will infect one and then another 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 until finally you have a congregation infected with jealousy and envy. All began because of pride. It begins with a whisper. Let me tell you about so-and-so. Oh yeah, tell me. What we ought to do is stop it right there and say, don't tell me if you've got to whisper it. If you can't tell me with them standing here, don't you tell me. But oftentimes what we want to do is let me tell you. Oh yes, let me hear it. And what we're doing is we're breeding that thing. And so what happens is then all of a sudden we have a congregation that is whispering, and then we have backbiting and envying of one another. Members become polarized over hurt feelings of one sort or another. They become jealous, and then it becomes very present to anybody who's among the congregation that there's jealousy and envy. Fighting and wrangling begins, and no one remembers the great work that the church is to be about. That's why it's such a danger. That's why Satan says, if I can just get them to be envious and jealous, then I've got them where I want them. They'll forget going out and drinking and trying to save the lost. They'll forget bringing their friends to church, because who wants to bring their friends to church where there is a congregation and when you walk in, you can feel it just like cutting a knife through a brick. It won't go. I've been in congregations like that before. And I'm sure many of you have as well. And you, if you've been in there before, you know what I'm talking about. You Christians are discouraged if you have them. And what happens? They fall away. You go and you visit with these people. And you say, tell me about why you're not going to church anymore. And they'll say, well, the reason why I'm not going is because it is some sour taste that has happened. And I'm sure that Brother Waldron has experienced this as well. When you've moved to a place and somebody says, oh, you need to go visit so-and-so. They used to go to church here. And they don't go anymore. And so you go and you talk to them. And you sit down and you begin to conversate with them about why they're not coming to church. And what they do is you find out that it happened over 15 years ago perhaps, or 20. There was jealousy and envy and strife. And they were weak. And they fell away. And you will have a hard time restoring those. Congregations oftentimes, even because of this matter, have split. And the results of this maim every member It maims the efforts of the congregations within the locality of which they have. There are now two congregations meeting in a city, and perhaps neither one of them are large enough to do the work of themselves. And everybody in the city, in the town, in the community knows these two churches can't get along. And what is it all about? Is it a matter of truth? If it is, then so be it. But when it's a matter of petty strife and envy and jealousy, Satan is rejoicing. God. Let us recognize as we fail in this regard, we're failing to do the work the church has been given to do. If we don't see the reality and the dangers of jealousy and envy. One verse let me know to share with you in this regard. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Here is a church, as I've been describing, a church that is divided. Factions, we might say. And like I say, when you've been there and you've experienced it, when it's a matter of truth and error, it's got to be. There's going to be a split. Heresies are going to be among you. You have to take a stand. But when it's a matter of strife, jealousy, envyings, evil speaking among brothers, it doesn't have to be. And so that was so much of what Paul was seeing when he came to Corinth, and he began to see the things that they were doing. Some were rallying behind one and then behind another. Some were saying, I'm of Paul. Some were saying, I'm of Apollos. And some were saying, I'm of Christ. Not necessarily those people, but he was using those people as a case. There were people who were rallying around and getting into groups and camps and saying, here's who I stand behind. Here's who I stand behind. And here's who I stand behind. Why were they standing behind these people? For truth and righteousness? No, Paul didn't see that at all. He saw what they were factions. He said there should be not these kinds of divisions among you. But notice what he says in chapter 3 now. He says, and brethren, I could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal. Even as unto babes, I fed you with milk, for you not and not with meat. For hitherto were you not able to bear it, neither are ye able now. But ye are yet carnal, for whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are ye not carnal and walk as men? For while one say, I am of Paul, another say, I am Apollos, are ye not carnal? Paul saw this problem at Corinth, and he said, you can't be the kind of church, you can't be doing what you ought to be doing, you can't be serving the Lord the way you're serving Him. You can't grow in that. You are going to remain as babes. And you see congregations like that, and you see a congregation, and it exists, and it exists, and it exists for years and years and years, and it doesn't grow. And sometimes the question is asked, what's the problem? There may be several reasons why there's a problem, but sometimes if you'll get right down to it, it may be because there's jealousy, envy, and pride. It may be that somebody says, a congregation that gets to a certain size is big enough. I can't control it if it gets over a certain size, so we have to clean house. That ought not be. So, let's get to the end of the lesson. And that is the cures for pride and jealousy and envy. The first thing we need to do, if we're going to have cures for this, is we need to be concerned for what is within. If you take your Bibles with me and turn over to Mark chapter 7, this is what we see Jesus taught, is that we need to be concerned about that which is on the inside. We said earlier that it is the thoughts of men that pride shows itself in. It is the thoughts of man where we see these jealous thoughts and envy begin. That's where it all begins. And so Jesus understands this. And he says, we need to be careful. We need to be concerned about what is within. Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 20, he said, that which cometh out of the man defileth the man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, and an evil eye. Blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. So if we're going to have a cure for pride, jealousy, and envy, we need to be concerned about what is on the inside. Jesus makes the point that we need to be concerned about what is within. Matthew chapter 23 is a case where Jesus makes this point. He says, don't be concerned about what is on the outward, but be concerned about what is on the inward. Verse 25, when he says unto the scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, woe unto you, for you make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, first cleanse that which is within of the cup and the platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for ye are like whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, ye are outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within ye are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Let's be concerned about what is within. If we're going to take care of pride, jealousy, and envy, that's what we have to do. The next thing we have to do is we have to have maturity and refocusing of our lives. We have to mature. We have to reorientate our lives. Turn back with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. I think we see this when we see Paul dealing with this problem at Corinth, where he was telling them that there was this envy and strife that was among them, that he caused the divisions and the factions that were among them. And I think here he tells them that they're going to mature. He says, for you're babes. You're not what you ought to be. You're babes. You're not ready for meat. You ought to be, but you're not, because of your carnality. And notice what he says in verse 5. Verse 5.